foundation in law. One of the royal judges then called Penn a pestilent fellow, threatened to gag him so that he could not speak, and ordered both prisoners to be kept in the bail dock during the trial. The bail dock, which Penn called a stinking hole, was a sort of holding cell. Penn, appealing to his jurors, demanded his rights as an Englishman, and Meade, also addressing the jurors, told them that they were his only judges. He lectured them on what constituted a riot. A judge observed that he ought to have his tongue cut out. From his bail dock, Penn, in a loud voice, notified the jurors that the judges were violating his rights under Magna Carta, but a judge informed the jurors that the guilt of the prisoners had already been proved. When four of the 12 jurors voted to acquit Meade, the court blamed one of them, Bushell, for having influenced the others contrary to the court's instructions. Bushell was told that he deserved to be indicted for his impudence, and the jurors were again instructed to fulfill their obligations. When asked for their verdict, the foreman of the jury declared, "Guilty of speaking in Gracechurch Street." One judge remarked that they might as well have said nothing, and another asked whether that meant guilty of an unlawful assembly. Bushell and the other minority jurors stood by their verdict, guilty of speaking in Gracechurch Street. That spurred a judge to vilify them with the most opprobrious language. Another judge told the jurors that they could not depart until they announced a verdict, provoking the recalcitrant jurors to insist that they had already given a verdict of not guilty. The next morning, when the court again demanded to know whether the jury had reached a verdict, the foreman repeated its decision, guilty of speaking in Gracechurch Street. The court inquired, to an unlawful assembly? Bushell denied it. When the court threatened to starve the jurors until they returned a positive verdict, Penn inquired whether the court accepted the verdict in Meade's case. The judges replied that no verdict existed. They reasoned that the two men had been indicted for conspiracy, and because one had been found not guilty and the other had received no verdict, it could not be a verdict. Penn nevertheless explained that the jury having acquitted Meade, he, Penn, was also free because you have indicted us for a conspiracy and I could not possibly conspire alone. The jury again repeated its verdict of guilty of speaking in the street, spurring the court to threaten that it would order the slitting of Bushell's nose. Penn angrily retorted that justice was impossible when juries were threatened and their verdicts rejected. A judge urged that Penn be gagged, tied, and staked to the ground, adding that instituting the Spanish Inquisition in England might be beneficial. Despite judicial recriminations against the jury, the jurors remained unbudgeable. The next day, when again asked for a verdict, they repeated their previous finding until the court so exasperated them that they reversed themselves by declaring that Penn was not guilty. The court promptly fined each juror 40 marks and ordered them all imprisoned until they paid the fines. When Penn insisted that he should be set free in accord with the jury's verdict, the court replied that he must be incarcerated in Newgate Prison along with his jurors until all fines were paid. The jurors were later discharged by the Court of Common Pleas, which ruled that their commitment was illegal. Bushell, however, had sought a writ of habeas corpus, thereby earning special attention from the King's Bench, the highest criminal court. Vaughan, the Lord Chief Justice of England, delivered its opinion, freeing him. Observing that Bushell's jailer was obligated to declare in his return to the writ the reasons for imprisonment, Vaughan insisted that the jailer must be as specific as possible. But the return of this case was so generally explained that the cause of Bushell's imprisonment could not be ascertained. Allowing a court to imprison a juror for contempt on the grounds that he had voted for an acquittal against the court's instructions on the law of the case subverted the functions of the jury. Indeed, the jury became a useless institution, Vaughan reasoned, if the judge controlled its understanding of the meaning of the law, which it was obligated to decide for itself. The jury could discharge its functions, said Vaughan, only if it was exempt from the judge's power to fine and jail its members. By such reasoning, the King's Bench emancipated juries, allowing them ever after to return verdicts based on their grasp of the law as well as of the facts. Thus, in 1697, Lord Chief Justice Holt reaffirmed that in all cases and in all actions, the jury may give a general or special verdict as well in causes criminal as civil, and the court ought to receive it. The king could discipline judges and dismiss lawyers, but jurors were impregnable. So that was a little perhaps complicated to hear on the ear, and I apologize if it was confusing, but the case of this brave man, Bushell, who stood up while threats of having his nose sliced who was actually held in jail under miserable conditions. One guy, I think, almost died as they held the jury in jail. And they didn't empty the chamber pots. They didn't send in food. It was a serious situation. And Jan, you have something to say about this?
Yeah, I just want to mention that.
Go ahead.
That's the kind of bravery that Robert was talking about, the kind of bravery that actually created our rights. And it takes something close to that level of bravery to maintain them in the face of government repression. So never think that your efforts to stand up to cops that don't know the law, or judges that don't know the law, or city council that doesn't want to pay any attention to the law, never think that that doesn't have an effect. You've got to the only way to hang on to these rights and keep them alive is just like muscles. You got to exercise them, and you got to exercise them often, preferably daily.
Yes, exercise your rights early and often. Forget about voting, but exercise your rights early and often. Don't forget about voting, but, you know, don't believe that voting has a lot of impact unless you're also doing a lot of other things at the same time. On the Iraqi war, looks like finally the AP is getting the message. If you look at the a story on the AP this morning, as I'm attempting to do as I spin down, does Iraq have banned weapons? It's a bad headline, but the story is actually containing elements of what's really going on in the national and international debate. And this is by John Lumpkin, AP. I'm going to read it. Before the war, the Bush administration portrayed Iraq as full of killer poisons with strange names and deadly effects, which terrorists could get a hold of and unleash on U.S. cities. These claims and fears have not been borne out so far. Was the intelligence regarding Iraq inaccurate or distorted between when it was gathered and presented to the world? Between when it was gathered and when it was presented to the world, Congress is looking into the matter. Prime Minister Tony Blair's government in Britain is facing similar scrutiny. A former State Department intelligence official who viewed classified intelligence gathered by the CIA and other agencies about Iraq's chemical, biological, nuclear programs during the run-up to the war accused the administration of distorting intelligence and presenting conjecture as fact. That's a State Department intelligence official probably covering his own ass. But when thieves fall out, ain't it the greatest? We finally get to see what's going on when there gets to be a split in the ruling class. And that's classically the situation in which revolutions can be successful. What disturbs me deeply is what I think are the disingenuous statements made from the very top about what the intelligence did say, said Greg Thielman, who retired in September. He was director of the Strategic Proliferation and Military Issues Office in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. On Friday, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency acknowledged he had no hard evidence of Iraqi chemical weapons last fall, but believed Iraq had a program in place to produce them. I believe. The assessment suggests greater uncertainty about the Iraqi threat than the administration indicated publicly. CIA Director George Tenet, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and top Pentagon officials have defended their pieces of the intelligence picture, saying they provided accurate assessments. Many top U.S. officials contend their pre-war assertions will yet be borne out. They say Iraq remains too dangerous to conduct a thorough search, but a new hunt is getting underway. Pre-war statements from President Bush, Powell, and intelligence officials offered many of the specific conclusions that drove the U.S. and Britain to invade Iraq. Most have yet to be validated. Most? How about finding me one that's been validated? Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons, Agent Powell said at the United Nations in February. In a paper released in October, U.S. intelligence agency said that Iraq had begun renewed production of chemical warfare agents, probably including mustard gas, sarin, cyclosarin, and VX. Chemical weapons have not been found in the part of Iraq that was controlled by President Saddam Hussein's government. Intelligence officials said Saddam would disperse his chemical weapons among the Iraqi Republican Guard units, which would use them if the government was about to fall. This, apparently, did not happen. Powell suggested military units had biological weapons in the field. On May 30th, Lieutenant General James Conway, the top Marine in Iraq, said, speaking about the hunt for chemical and biological weapons, "We've been to virtually every ammunition supply point between the Kuwaiti border and Baghdad, but they're simply not there." The pre-war intelligence paper said Iraq had established a large-scale, redundant, and concealed biological weapon agent production capability, which included mobile facilities. Allied forces in Iraq had found two truck trailers equipped with fermenters. The CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency said last week they concluded the vehicles probably are parts of a mobile biological weapons production facility, and this is contradicted by a story out of the London Observer yesterday, which I don't know if I'm going to have time to read. Bush seized on the finds as proof Iraq had prohibited weapons. No complete production system has been found, and tests show no trace of biological agents in either trailer. So far, it seems as if all leads have been followed up have come to nothing. So many false claims have been made in the past, it can only be politically driven. Responsible governments take time to investigate, said Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest in London. It's like the boy who cried wolf. The credibility of these claims is shot. Powell also has told the UN that numerous intelligence reports over the past decade from sources inside Iraq indicated a covert force of up to a few dozen Scud-variant ballistic missiles. None has been found. U.S. allegations that Iraq was trying to develop a nuclear weapon have also not been verified. Much discussed were some high-strength aluminum tubes Iraq tried to import. The CIA argued that these were for centrifuges, essential to a nuclear weapons program. Experts from the State and Energy Departments said they were for conventional artillery rockets, Thielman said. No centrifuges have been reported found. In his State of the Union address, Bush said that Britain had learned that Saddam recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. The claim rested significantly on a letter or letters between officials in Iraq and Niger that were obtained by European intelligence agencies. The communications are now accepted as forged. The administration also suggested Iraq supported terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda connection was built around the movements of Abu Musab Zarqawi, a senior associate of Osama bin Laden. Zarqawi received medical treatment in Baghdad in 2002 and supported an Islamic extremist movement in Kurdish Iraq outside Saddam's reach. A mid-level associate of Zarqawi was detained near Baghdad after the war. Zarqawi himself remains at large. Some reports indicated Al-Qaeda operatives had sought chemical and biological weapons expertise from Iraq, but there was little evidence. Little evidence? How about some evidence? How about any evidence that Iraq supplied any? This is from an AP story. This is the mainline press talking here. So this is significant stuff when this shows up. And here's our leftist friend Alexander Cockburn, or Alexander Cockburn, on the Counterpunch Diary. You can catch him at www.counterpunch.org. It's hard to choose which deserves the coarser jest, the excited baying in the press about the non-discovery of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or the wailing in the press about the 3-2 decision of the FCC last week to allow corporate media giants to increase their domination of the market. Actually, they're all part of the same binding curve of nonsense, and if we meld the two, we're left with the following ridiculous proposition, most keenly promoted by Democrats, eager to impart the impression that only greedy Republicans are served of the corporate media titans, and that the Telecommunications, quote, Reform Act of 1996 was actually a well-intended effort to return the airwaves to us, the people. The ridiculous proposition? Until the FCC vote this week, we, the people surfing through the TV channels or across the AM-FM radio dial, were afforded diversity of choice, the better to form those reasoned political judgments essential in the functioning of this democratic republic. The ridiculous proposition continued in the run-up to the U.S.-UK attack on Iraq, and before the latest FCC ruling unleashed darkness upon the land, we were afforded a multiplicity of analyses, not just from hole-in-the-wall operations like Pacifica or satellite-based Lynx TV. Night after night, the bulk of the American people were able to enjoy well-informed reporting, suggesting that the Bush administration's accusations that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction ready to use in as little as 45 minutes had no factual foundation. But now, after the FCC decision, these voices will be stilled. We are entering the era of Big Brother. You think I'm joking? Here is what one of the two Democratic FCC commissioners, Michael J. Kopp, said before the vote, with his grand words now approvingly quoted by liberal editorial writers and pundits. Today, the FCC empowers the America's new media elite with unacceptable levels of influence over the ideas and information upon which our society and our democracy so heavily depend. The decision we five make today will recast our entire media landscape for years to come. At issue is whether a few corporations will be ceded enhanced gatekeeper control over the civil dialogue of our country, more content control over our music, entertainment, and information, and veto power over the majority of what our families watch, hear, and read. Now, didn't this happen, 40, 50, or maybe 70 years ago? Of course it did. The damage was done long, long since. And all that happened on June 2nd is that it got slightly worse, but not to any degree instantly apparent to the long-suffering national audience. So just as you suspected, we're getting lousy info from the corporate press before the FCC vote this week. The press is now happily passing the buck to the intelligence services and quoting former analysts from the CIA and DIA, wailing that objectivity collapsed in the face of political pressure. We're shocked, shocked. Anyone remember how the neocons forced an outside posse of experts, known as Team B, into the CIA in the mid-1970s? Because Team A, the CIA regulars, were turning in reports saying that the Soviet Union was not quite the fearsome power the neocons supposed it to be. Anyone remember all those accusations by the late Sam Adams and others that the CIA fudged the numbers in the Vietnam War because of political pressure from the White House? Intelligence services, or at least their chiefs, invariably succumb in the face of political bullying. But it didn't matter that the CIA and the DIA were cowed by wild men in Rumsfeld's Department of Defense, who said Iraq was still bristling with weapons of mass destruction. Any enterprising news editor could have found, and some did, plenty of solid evidence to support the claim that Saddam had destroyed his weapons of mass destruction, that he had no alliance with al-Qaeda. In the run-up to the attack on Iraq, the worst journalistic outrages came in two publications at the supposed pinnacle of the profession. The New York Times, which recycled the Iraqi exile Ahmad Shalabi's agenda through its reporter Judith Miller, and The New Yorker, which printed Jeffrey Goldberg's nonsense about the Saddam al-Qaeda connection. There was no consequence of media concentration or the perversion of intelligence analysis by political priorities. Simply on the grounds of common sense about the prejudices of her source, Howell Raines, the now ousted executive editor of the New York Times, could have told Miller to qualify her reports. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, could have just as easily punched holes in Goldberg's story. Instead, they delightedly hyped shoddy journalism that played a far greater role in the White House's propaganda blitz than the performance of the cowed CIA and DIA. It's easy to be right after the event. It takes fiber to stand out against the war party when it was in full cry. The bulk of the mainstream press failed dismally in its watchdog role, and a little more forthrightness about this failure would be welcome indeed. But can we expect the hounds of war like Tim Russert to apologize? Of course not. Some senator will probably sometime soon grill the CIA's George Tenet and other intelligence chiefs who failed in our hour of need. But Russert or Miller or Raines or Remnick or Punch's Salzberger? Never. Ed Rosenthal, further thoughts on that one-day sentence. As noted here a couple of days ago, Ed Rosenthal got one day in prison and a $1,000 fine from federal judge Charles Breyer for supplying medical marijuana under the aegis of the city of Oakland. Of course, we're delighted Ed didn't get the prison time the prosecutor was calling for, also that Breyer had to acknowledge the public outcry and the fury of the jury he misled. But there is a downside, and it's set forth well by Clay Conrad, chairman of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Here are some notes Conrad sent us last week. This result is good for Ed. It is great for Ed. It is for itself a major news event. However, we've got to deal with the fact that for the issue, it sucks. A huge injustice is the best headline grabber for motivating future juries to nullify. Here are a few of the problems I see with this. One, the next jury says, hey, it's not like these folks will do any serious jail time. Two, the focus of the media was no longer on the Rosenthal jury. Breyer stole their thunder. Three, some activists preparing to work on future cases figure it's a waste of energy because it's not like a major injustice is being done. And four, some of the Rosenthal jurors may abandon ship, figuring Ed's liberty was not interrupted, so they've achieved their major purpose and go back to their non-activist lives. A few of the things I think we need to focus on. One, Ed's sentence is in the news because it is such a surprise. If he got a predictable 5 years, nobody would have raised an eyebrow at the sentence itself. Just as this judge departed downward, the next may depart upward. One reason why juries need to nullify in these cases is because they cannot know what sentence the judge may impose, a day or a lifetime. 2. Breyer only gave a one-day sentence because the jury put the pressure on him. Again, this underlines the power and importance of independent juries. Breyer was ashamed and chastised by the jurors, who can take the real credit for the one-day sentence. Had the jury not gone public, Breyer would very likely have given the far longer sentence the government was asking for. 3. The activists need to know that this sentence means they are winning at least some battles, and there is no excuse for not redoubling their efforts. 4. The Rosenthal jurors should know that this isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. The government took some lumps this time on sentencing, but they might well get a life sentence in the next round. The injustice isn't what was done to Rosenthal, it's what is being done to defendants all across California, and it's all across Santa Cruz County, folks. And it's not just the medical marijuana defendants. It's every single person in jail for marijuana today. And there's 750,000 arrests a year federally. Keep that in mind. 750,000 people are being jailed every year for this offense. The government often wins these types of appeals, and reversals on appeals rarely make headlines. Ed could end up doing 78 months after all, and nobody in the public will even be aware of it. Clay S. Conrad, and that's from the Counterpunch website, and a story by Alexander Coburn. Lots of good stuff that I intended to read, and of course, a lot of stuff I hope to play, but I haven't been able to do that. I was going to talk to you about the protests in San Francisco, and hopefully I'll be able to talk to you about what's going on as protesters' cases get dismissed and new people get arrested for protesting Bechtel. Go, protesters in San Francisco. We need some protests down here, and hopefully we'll have some more against the elimination of civil rights on the mall. Hopefully you'll be able to come to Jan Golder's forum tomorrow, I should say Tuesday, day after tomorrow, 5:30, second floor of the library. If you want to fight the permit parking nonsense, it's going to criminalize people in their vehicles and criminalize people's vehicles. You don't even need to be in your vehicle anymore. 7 o'clock, City Council, speak at oral communications. Then the first item on the agenda is this bogus permit parking nonsense. Call the City Council, 420-5020, and tell them, any individual council member of your choice, we want you to call City Hall and the City Manager's office and say, no removal of the planter seats until you've got alternate seating space, until you've had a public process. It's a fair message to send. And finally, here's this from Iraq. Police station torn down in defiant Fallujah. After the war, U.S. presence comes under fierce attack. Iraqis carrying hammers and axes yesterday began to demolish, actually Friday, a police station in the troubled city of Fallujah in a public act of defiance against the U.S. military. In what appeared to be a well-organized operation, a crowd of laborers, mostly young men and boys, sawed off railings and tore out the metal window frames from the three-story police building. Others, using mallets and metal poles, knocked down the outer wall brick by brick and were slowly trying to break apart the building itself. Although the Al-Tanwid police station was ransacked in the days immediately after the war, the U.S. military had used the building intermittently as a center for operations in Fallujah and were negotiating to set up a full-time base there. Early on Thursday, one soldier was killed and 5 were injured outside the building when they were attacked with a rocket-propelled grenade. That attack was a warning to the Americans, said Arkan Habib. Notice, a man who gives his name, a man who apparently is not afraid to stand up against the most heavily armed military in the world. Arkan Habib, 32, who stood in the rubble of the station yesterday. We have told them more than once that this is a residential area and we don't want them here. We have destroyed the walls. We took the windows and now we are going to destroy the whole building, he said. We are cleansing the place of Americans. It was unclear who had organized the operation, although some in the crowd said that the orders and equipment had been provided by local mosques. Graffiti has appeared on the walls of Fallujah in recent days in support of the attacks against Americans. Fallujah will be a fire burning the invaders, said one message painted in Arabic. God bless the Mujahideen at the city of the mosques, said another. Fallujah has emerged as a center of anti-American resentment that covers a broad area of the country to the west of the capital of Baghdad. In another attack yesterday, rocket-propelled grenades were fired at a U.S. Abrams tank, that's the day before yesterday, Friday, and a Humvee patrolling near Khalidia, a small town close to Fallujah. No one was hurt. The area is populated by Iraqi's Sunni Muslim minority, many of whom prospered under the regime of Saddam Hussein. American generals have described the resistance as coming from Baathists and Saddam loyalists, but many in the crowd that gathered outside the police station in Fallujah yesterday insisted that they had welcomed the fall of Saddam Hussein, but were angered by the continued U.S. military presence in a town dominated by a deeply conservative religious and tribal culture. "We are not loyal to Saddam. He was a dictator and tyrant. Now he is gone, but the Americans are acting like dictators themselves," said Mesner Al-Jamali, an unemployed man in the crowd. "Oh, for someone downtown who would say the same thing about our police force and our merchants, because that's what we're facing in Santa Cruz. No, we're not facing people with rifles who are shooting us down. We are facing with people with guns who are telling us, surrender your rights, or we're going to arrest you and cite you and harass you. And if you resist those tickets, we're going to use necessary force to subdue you. That is what we have on the streets of Santa Cruz downtown." "Around 300 U.S. troops have been in Fallujah since mid-April. Now more than 1,500 combat soldiers, with not a peep of protest from Emily Riley or Representative Farr or the Santa Cruz City Council, not a word of protest, folks, on this issue, are setting up base outside the town, preparing to be deployed in an effort to tackle the resistance." I like the phraseology here, tackle the resistance. Like shoot lead into their kids? Tackle the resistance. "Much of the resentment comes from the actions of the U.S. troops themselves. Last month, soldiers shot 18 protesters over separate days when a crowd demonstrated outside their base. There have also been aggressive house searches, which have angered many. After the rocket attack on Thursday, U.S. troops ordered all men out of the houses opposite and spent 3 hours searching them. Yesterday, Kamlis Chazim, 35, who lives in one of the buildings with his extended family, showed locks that had been cut open, door handles broken off, and cupboard doors smashed open. 'We didn't have any guns in the house. We didn't have anything,' he said. 'The soldiers didn't speak Arabic, and they didn't have a translator. There was nothing we could say to stop them. We think they should leave our town now. They haven't achieved anything for us.' Most Iraqis listen regularly to Arabic service radio stations and are keenly aware of the pronouncements of the British and U.S. governments and the steps taken by the U.S.-led authority in Baghdad. Many are aware of the delayed political process, which means an Iraqi government is unlikely to emerge for at least a year. Last night, Paul Bremer, the U.S. official running Iraq, met around 17 Iraqi politicians to discuss his plan to appoint a political council of up to 30 people as the first step to forming a government. Officials have tried to widen the number of politicians included in the process, and three women, the first to be involved in the discussions, were invited to last night's meeting. Several of the political groups are angry that Mr. Bremer has abandoned an earlier decision to hold a large national conference to elect, rather than appoint, a council. But yesterday, a senior official at the Coalition Provisional Authority defended the decision, saying there was not enough security or sufficiently developed political parties to hold a vote. "If you had an electoral process today, I think it would lead to a more instability right now rather than less," the official said. I think that the Iraqis are going to show the American military instability. I think that they're going to see instability very, very vividly in the weeks ahead. And I think that a lot of innocent people, including soldiers, who are, I suppose, not innocent because they're soldiers and they're in uniform, but they are under considerable pressures to obey orders, are going to suffer because of our failure in Santa Cruz to speak out on this issue. So it's time to speak out. U.S. out of Iraq. End the Iraqi occupation. No, it's not a done deal. We got to do it. Yes, it's the same struggle as it was 6 months ago, as it was a year ago. We have to undertake it. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My relief here on the talk show has not showed up yet, so I'm taking liberties, as I often do. But I'm probably pretty shortly going to put on some music because I've got to get going. My father's 93rd birthday is today, bless his heart. I'm going to go see what he's doing and wish him well. We're going to wind this down, I guess, today. Lots of interesting stuff. That last article, by the way, in case you wonder where it was from, it looks like it was from the London Observer Saturday. Rory McCarthy wrote the article. London Observer has lots of good stuff. Go on the internet, find the London Observer. They have like 8 or 9 articles on Iraq in the Sunday Observer today. You don't have to go down to the Capitola Book Cafe and pay $5 or $8 for a London Observer. You can actually get it free on the internet, but often you can't get it unless you get it on the day, although they sometimes have some archives. Here's another story. Was shocked by poor weapons intelligence. Blix, Pentagon agency, doubted threat posed by Saddam. This is by Ewan McCaskill, Richard Norton Taylor, and Suzanne Goldberg in Washington. The UN chief weapons inspector, again from the London Observer, Hans Blix, expressed his disappointment yesterday at the quality of the intelligence given to him by the U.S. and Britain before the war with Iraq. Mr. Blix, who retires at the end of the month, told the BBC, "We went to a great many sites that were given to us by intelligence, and only in 3 cases did we find anything, and they did not relate to weapons of mass destruction. That shook me a bit, I must say." He added, "I thought, my God, if this is the best intelligence they had and we find nothing, what about the rest?" As he was speaking, the credibility of the White House claim that Saddam Hussein posed an imminent threat to the world took a further blow when it emerged that the Pentagon's intelligence branch had doubts about Iraq's capabilities. Gee, I wonder why. Having been bombed into submission and invaded in 1991, and then starved to death for the next 12 years, one would imagine they might not be in the best shape. Of course, we all knew that, didn't we? But we let them proceed. Well, some of us said no. Some of us had our little token demonstrations and our little token arrests. I don't know. It's hard to say how far you need to go to stop this kind of war criminal aggression. You know, what could you say to people in Nazi Germany as they blitzed into Poland shouting, "Poor little Memel!" Memel, you know, that was where the Germans were being mistreated by the Poles, according to Goebbels and the Nazi propaganda machine. That's what was going on in 1939. And, you know, we have to support our troops in Poland who are holding down the country, that sort of thing. You know, we have to support our troops in Iraq who are holding down the country. Why aren't more people calling for U.S. out of Iraq? Got to speak up, folks. Speak up. Loud. I don't see those letters in the paper anymore. I don't hear those statements on the street. I don't see those buttons on people's lapels. I hear people are doing it once a week at the Peace Friday. I'm glad, but we got to do more. In Santa Cruz, they've criminalized having a table for more than an hour downtown. Can anybody smell the coffee here? I hope so. Huff will be meeting on Wednesday, and we'll probably be doing tabling downtown in front of the Pacific Trading Company before them, and we're hoping to get other organizations to join us to, in essence, resist these laws and to say, if you're going to remove the First Amendment, you get to remove us along with it. And we're not going to go quietly. The same kind of advice that Robert Letterman had, which is to make it a large media event. Hasn't been lined up, hasn't been arranged yet. It needs to be done. 423-HUFF is the number to call to get that on board. And, gosh, so many good stories here. A lot of good stories on Iraq, as I've said. Some police brutality up in Seattle around critical mass. Here in Santa Cruz, I had an interesting interview with a witness to the police brutality of critical mass a week ago against critical mass. But it looks like I'm about to be evicted from the studio. I hear the sound of drums, and it's, hey, he's got his button on, war without end, not in our name. Does this mean you oppose the Iraqi, the U.S. occupation of Iraq?
Why do you always put me on the spot when I'm in a hurry to get out of here? Yes, of course I oppose the war.
Right.
I mean,
like,
what do you think? I mean, what a stupid question. What do you think about this MTV koi fish killing?
Robert.
At this point, I'll have to...
my
assistant here on that.
Listen, point well taken.
I want to thank Jan Golder for coming into the studio, and I want to forgive Vinny, our V-man, for rushing into the studio, and indeed, this is now some pleasant music time to take a break from all this babble. What do we got coming up, Vinny?
That is as yet to be determined. As well, you see, there was a show called In the Red Light District, and they just kind of up and decided not to do it anymore and really didn't notify anybody about it except me. So it kind of falls on me to deal with. I'm not bitter at all or anything like that. I hope that nobody's reading any bitterness into this vective that I'm...
Vinny.
And So, well, we shall turn on the CD player here like so, or rather like that, and I don't know, what do you say? How about some Seize the Day, Robert? Shall we just Seize the Day?
My time is finished here.
You want to say something?
Thank you for being with us, 423 Huff, and leave us a message and come on down and just say no to bad laws on the mall and worse police practices.
And when's your next show again?
I am on Thursday, 6 to 8 in the evening, assuming I'm at liberty. If I'm not, let's just gather outside the jail and do a sing-along.
Well, it appears that the Seize the Day CD is missing, so we're going to hear some Cat Power as opposed to Seize the Day. And hopefully this CD will fucking skip.